definitely need the full hour this morning. So, I will note a couple of things first. You saw on the email that I sent out in the beginning of the week, I included there the flyer for our next session. It will be in January, God willing. It will run for 4 Wednesdays. I believe the dates are 9th, 16th, 23rd, and 30th. I hope those are Wednesdays. And our topic is the story of Daniel. We will be studying the book of Daniel, starting from the destruction of the first temple and continuing through his bizarre adventures all the way through the writing on the wall of King Belshazzar and the end of the Babylonian Empire. You did get the flyer in the email. I will probably be sending it out again soon to the entire list of people who come to the Beth Emeth classes. Please sign up. In the event that you are going to some warmer climate for some reason, you can still sign up. You can still get the audios and the handouts by email and so on. Just go to the website or call the office or email me, however you do it. But please make sure that you sign up for that. Also, for those who are staying here, Tuesday, December 25th, I mentioned it last week, we're having a full day of classes on heroes and villains of Tanakh, celebrating the 10th year of my Beit Midrash. We are having classes on 10 heroes and 10 villains. So they're going to be half-hour classes. You can just come spend half an hour and go. I put, by the hot water, I put some flyers listing all the classes. It starts at 9 a.m. It runs until 9 p.m. You can stay for ice cream at 9 o'clock in the evening if you like. We have a free light lunch. The whole program is free of charge. Again, you can see the flyers there. It's going to be at Yeshivat Or Chaim, 159 Almore Avenue, the corner of Almore and Faywood, not far from here. It's a 5-minute drive from here. Okay, so our topic this morning is the fourth in our four-part series, Introduction to Jewish Bioethics, and the topic is, as I called it at the top of the sheet, assisted death. I'm not terribly interested in the debate about whether we call this medical assistance in dying, whether we call it assisted suicide. The reality is it's all of the above, and the politics of it, and you know, which side are you on, and therefore what do you call the person on the other side, are really uninteresting when it comes to the fundamental question here, which is the following. Can physical harm ever be viewed as a medical act? As an act of healing. I've discussed this topic in different contexts in different ways, but I think in terms of our discussion about ethics, we've been trying to drill down to the core ethical questions in each of the issues we've addressed. So when we dealt with abortion, we asked the question of, is the fetus considered a human life? When we dealt with cosmetic surgery, we asked the question of, who owns the body? What justifies wounding or endangering the body? When we dealt with healthcare and charging for healthcare, we asked, does a doctor have a right to charge for fulfilling what is essentially a religious duty? And so the question here is, can physical harm, in the sense of ending somebody's life, ever be viewed as a medical act, as a healing act? And despite the fact that feelings run so high on this, and despite the fact that we're talking about one of the most serious, if not the most serious, maybe one of the most serious issues you can address in Judaism, literally an issue which some people will call healing and others will call murder, really I think it's healthy for us to recognize that there's a lot of pain in this issue, there's a lot of difficulty in this issue, and people who are very well-meaning and very religious people will still look at this and come out with different conclusions on the topic. Even though I think the Jewish law conclusion is actually relatively straightforward, as we'll see at the end. This case resembles the abortion discussion. In the sense that we have relevant biblical law. We're not left in a vacuum here in terms of what the biblical text wants to say. We're not relying on trying to read into biblical ethics. The biblical law on it is fairly straightforward. And the role of the rabbis is to figure out simply how to apply it. There is a lot of material. I spoke, and I guess it's 4 years ago now, when Quebec was putting forth Bill 52 to license assisted death. At the time, I spoke to a group of rabbis in Ottawa about the topic and went on there for an hour and a half, and we could have gone a lot longer then. If you take a look on your sheet at number 5, You'll see two links that I gave you there for those who do want more extensive information than we'll get to today. The first one is a class on the topic of medical assistance in dying. It's one that I taught for CME credit for doctors right after the Carter decision from the Supreme Court. And then the second one was a follow-up session on the issue of effective referral, because what we have currently in Ontario is a system in which doctors who refuse to participate in this are still required to provide referral to somebody else who will be able to do the job. And that's its own ethical question. It's funny, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario has taken upon itself the mantle of religion and has said, even if your religion will not allow you to do this, we believe it is not religiously difficult for you to refer to somebody else. They have issued a religious, they passed it. They said, don't worry about it, your religion allows you to refer to somebody else. That's actually quite a contentious issue, not only for Jews. That's an issue for Western religions in general. And that's a class, that link that you see there is a link to a class on that topic. Fundamentally, what we're talking about here is a problem of suffering. And if you take a look at the first source on your sheet, pulled off of the Wikipedia page for the case of Rodriguez v. British Columbia, this is the case which laid the groundwork in many ways for the Carter decision, which said that assisting somebody to end their life not only may not be considered criminal, but actually may be required under certain circumstances by Canadian law. That decision was not on this case. That decision was on the Carter case. But the Rodriguez case was the one that laid the groundwork. It's a heart-wrenching case. Take a look at the description here. Sue Rodriguez was a 42-year-old mother whose illness, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, was diagnosed in 1992. By 1993, it was found she would not live more than a year. And so she began a crusade to strike down the section of the criminal code which made assisted suicide illegal. To the extent it would be illegal for a terminally ill person to commit physician-assisted suicide. In other words, going back to the 1970s, suicide was not a criminal act. That was already taken care of many years ago. But helping somebody to do so was considered a criminal act. It was considered, whether you call it accessory to murder, I'm not a lawyer, so that, ask the lawyers what exactly it was considered, but the criminal code forbade helping somebody to take their own life. So she applies for getting the assistance of somebody else to end her life to not be considered a crime, to strike that down. She applied to the Supreme Court of British Columbia to have the section struck down because it allegedly violated Section 7, the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, 12, protection against cruel and unusual punishment, and 15 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and that's the one on equality. And in fact, she loses the case. But in the Carter decision in 2015, the decision made on the Rodriguez case was overturned. And what they argued essentially was that in the event that you deprive somebody of the ability to take their life while they're still able to make that decision and while they're still able to act on that decision, then what you're doing is depriving them of the liberty to do so, and forcing them to shorten their life because they're going to have to act to take their life earlier on while they're still capable of doing it independently. There's more to it, but that's essentially the logic involved. So obviously there's a lot of rancor on both sides, as I mentioned at the outset. One of the concerns that are involved is the fear of what is called the slippery slope. Right? If you're going to permit it for this, if you're going to permit it for this woman with ALS who's going to die within a year, what comes next? The truth of the matter is that slippery slope is a misnomer. Because it's not a slippery slope at all. Right? I mean, what it is a cliff. No, in all seriousness. Meaning this is binary. This is yes or no. It's not a slope. It's not if you permit this, one day you might permit that. The same logic that says, if you don't allow her to get a doctor's help now, or require, really, it's a requirement. If you don't require a doctor to help her do this right now, was not only going to apply to the woman who is going to die within the year of ALS, that's also going to apply to anybody else who is of sound mind and able to say that they want to die. Why should it be limited to somebody who's going to die within a year? Why should it be limited to somebody who has a particular health condition? Once you argue that a person's liberty guarantees them the right to be helped by somebody else, and in fact to put that expectation on somebody else, why should anybody be prevented from doing so? That's the argument. And I think it's legally sound. I think that one is automatic to the other, so that you end up with what's happened in Belgium. Take a look at source number two. This is from 2014. The vote on Thursday by Belgium's House of Representatives removed all age restrictions on the right of the incurably sick to end their lives. A minor could do it too. They can't have a beer, but they could make this order, a vote that has caused considerable controversy. So that's 2014. Fast forward, 2018, in an article from last week. Belgium investigates doctors who euthanized 38-year-old woman with Asperger's syndrome. Belgian officials are investigating whether doctors improperly euthanized a woman with autism, the first criminal investigation in a euthanasia case since the practice was legalized in 2002. I'm more shocked by that than anything else, the fact that it's the very first criminal investigation in 16 years. Three doctors from East Flanders are being investigated on suspicion of having, quote, poisoned, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name, Tyne Nies, I believe, in 2010. The 38-year-old had been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, a mild form of autism, 2 months before she died in an apparently legal killing by a doctor. Belgium is one of two countries, along with the Netherlands, where euthanasia of people for psychiatric reasons is allowed if they can prove they have, quote, unbearable and untreatable suffering. Among Belgians euthanized for mental health reasons, the most common conditions are depression, personality disorder, and Asperger's. Many experts in Belgium and beyond dispute whether autism should be considered a valid reason to be killed. Last year, the Associated Press reported that after her family filed a criminal complaint alleging numerous irregularities in her death, her doctors attempted to block the investigation. And here's a quote from the doctor. "We must try to stop these people," wrote Dr. Leif Thienpont, the psychiatrist who approved Nies's request to die, and one of the doctors now facing charges. "It is a seriously dysfunctional, wounded, traumatized family with very little empathy and respect for others," the message read. That's her defense and her reason why they should not investigate the case at all. This is a logical result of the decision. Meaning, once you say that failure to carry this out is an infringement on a person's rights, I don't know why you should make any distinction between someone who's suffering from ALS and someone who's suffering from a psychological psychiatric disorder. It's their right to make that demand. With the minors, I think it's a little harder because there is the idea that they don't have the ability to properly assess and make long-term decisions. Their brains aren't even developed to that extent. But that's the basic argument, is that all of these cases come under one heading, which is once you say that effectively what you are doing is the kindest thing that can be done, and therefore this is what they have a right to expect, the same thing is going to apply to a wide range of cases. One of the challenges that you do run into is what I referred to before regarding effective referral, which is, well, what about a doctor who says, that wasn't why I went into medicine, right? When I went through medical, not me, I am not a doctor, but the doctor says, when I went through medical school, right, when I put myself through all those hours in residency, and when I started my practice, I didn't intend to be ending people's lives, right? I didn't know that was going to be a requirement in order for me to be able to keep my license and to practice. You have a real problem. And I talk to doctors all the time about this. This is very much on their minds. And it's an issue in facilities that are under religious auspices. Take a look at source number four, please. This is from earlier this year in the Globe and Mail. You may have seen this case. Assisted dying in religious facilities means tough choices for families. The story was that somebody was in such a facility. It was under religious auspices. They wanted assisted death. The facility's policy was not to have it conducted there. And so what they ended up doing was smuggling somebody in to end the patient's life. That left Lola Hyman, the younger of Mr. Hyman's two daughters and his main caregiver, with a choice. She could transfer her father to an unfamiliar clinic to die, or she could sneak Ellen Veeb, one of the country's leading doctor advocates of assisted dying, into her father's room to help him die in his own bed. Lola and the rest of her immediate family settled on the latter. They would deal with the fallout later. And so that's what they did. The article describes how they stationed somebody from the family outside the door to distract anybody who was trying to come in order to enable this to go on inside, as though the people who run the facility have no rights of their own and have no ability to say what they will and will not permit there. This is a colossal mess. And again, it's a colossal mess because there's such pain involved. You can't fail to sympathize with the people who are in this position, whatever your conclusion on what ought to be done. And that's what makes this such a challenge. So, yeah, recognizing that I've now been speaking for 16 minutes straight, and I'm planning to speak probably for the next 44 minutes straight, just as there's so much to talk about here, what I would like to do is to be able to lay out the issue and to take questions after that when we see how much time we have, but I want to make sure to lay this out properly. For this. No, I'm all right. Thanks. Okay. So, what you have here are two clear-cut opposing rules within Judaism. Rule number one, there is a clear-cut imperative in Judaism to relieve people's pain and suffering. We talked about this already last week when we talked about the imperative to heal, right, and the duty that that medical personnel have to take care of people and take care of people's health. And we had it from love your neighbor, and we had it from the biblical verse that says he shall surely heal. We had all these different verses that spoke of the imperative to heal, but it's not only about restoring life. It's also about saving people from pain, because within Jewish law, we tend to view pain as the equal to or even worse than death. Take a look at source number 6. This is a classic example that is brought regarding this. The story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. I suppose it's a little bit of an advertisement as well for the Daniel series that we have coming up, because it comes from the book of Daniel. The story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah essentially is this. There is a plot in the Babylonian court against those Jews who don't bow down to idols. And the way the plot is created is this. The king makes a great big statue, and he declares that when music plays, everyone has to bow down to the statue. What the statue represents, why music, comes to the Daniel class in January and you'll find out. But that's the core part of the story for our purposes. Everyone has to bow down. Jews don't do that. Daniel happens to be out of town when this happens, but his three allies in the king's court, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, are there. Music plays, they refuse to bow down. They are cast into a fiery furnace, and miraculously they survive. Not so much the people who threw them in. But look at the Talmud's line. Had the Babylonians whipped Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they would have worshipped the idol. Had they been whipped instead of threatened with being thrown into the furnace, they would have bowed down. It's making a statement about what people can and cannot withstand. They're willing to give up their lives, but enduring torture can actually be harder. Enduring pain can be harder than making a yes or no decision and sacrificing their lives. That's the Talmudic statement. And we generally view, as a result of this and other sources, we generally view mitigation of pain as being on par with saving somebody's life. So, for example, source number 7 addresses a topic we're going to come back to a little bit later called the double effect. Anyone familiar with the double effect? The double effect is a Christian term for an idea which is an overall philosophical problem. Here's the issue. The Torah talks about a home invasion and says that if somebody is in his house at night and he hears a burglar and is able to, has a weapon, has the ability to defend against the invader, that person has the right to kill the invader. Unless they know clearly that the invader would not kill them, they have they have the ability to defend themselves. You're saving yourself as opposed to killing somebody else. That's the way that it is viewed. It's Exodus chapter 21. Christian thinkers look at that and say, well, wait a minute. Not so fast. That means that you're killing somebody else to save yourself. It's a single action with two effects, double effect. You are saving yourself, but you're killing somebody else. It's not allowed. I think it's Thomas Aquinas who first had this problem and coined the... And Nachon. Judaism, we say, as Ruchama notes, somebody comes to kill you, get up early to kill him. Thomas is not so happy with that. He doesn't like that idea. He says, no, you're not allowed to do that. And it's a fascinating discussion philosophically, at least to all sorts of other questions, which you've heard in some context, in university or somewhere else, like the trolley car questions, right? The car is running down the track, and if it continues down this track, it'll kill two people. But if you flip the switch, it'll go down the other track, but it'll kill one person, but it's your action that's causing it. All those philosophical questions are tied into what happens when you perform an action for a good purpose, but it's going to have a negative purpose as well. And the question comes up in cases of end-of-life care surrounding the issue of certain painkillers, which, it is argued, can potentially reduce a person's life expectancy. Now, there's a lot of medical literature on this. I'm going to say something which some doctors will challenge, because it's a debate. And that is, does the use of morphine depress the patient's breathing? That's the fundamental issue. I have been told by physicians in palliative care that if you titrate it properly, you will not damage the patient's breathing. I have been told by other physicians that who work in such situations that it's not true. Of course, it's going to weaken the patient's breathing. I, not being a doctor, am not weighing in. It's not the point. The question that is asked is, what if your patient is in great pain? And the only way that you can mitigate the patient's pain is by administering something that might in fact shorten the patient's life. That's the double effect question. Rabbi Waldenberg weighed in on it in source number 7. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, we've mentioned him in previous classes as somebody who answered many medical ethics questions for physicians at Shaarei HaTzedek Hospital for many, many years. He says, whether the medical means are pills or injections, so long as they are given by a doctor with the goal of lessening his great suffering, this is part of the Torah's permission to the physician to heal. In other words, if the goal is alleviating pain, you don't worry about the potential negative impact. Now, mind you, one added note, which we're going to come back to later, is that you can't do it if it's guaranteed to end the patient's life. If it's guaranteed that this dose, not the course, but if it's guaranteed that this dose would actually kill the patient, then he says no. But if you know that it can happen over the course of time with these, but no particular dose can be pinpointed as the one that's going to put him over the edge, then Rabbi Waldenberg is fine with it. Your intent is to mitigate the patient's pain. I bring it here not to discuss double effect. We're going to come back to double effect. But I bring it here in order to show you the imperative of mitigating pain as part of medical treatment. And we include within this not only physical pain, but human dignity. We talked about dignity a little bit in our cosmetic surgery discussion, but human dignity may be a factor here as well. So that's all on one side. I have a clear-cut imperative to relieve pain and suffering. I also have a clear-cut prohibition against murder. And that includes where somebody wants to kill themselves. The Torah says, among other prohibitions, lo tirzach, you shall not commit murder. And if you take a look at source number 8, Maimonides codifies this based on the Talmudic discussion. One may not even wound, forget kill, one may not wound himself or any other person. Why not? Why am I not allowed to decide to wound myself? Logically, what's the argument? Sorry? Doesn't belong to you, right? Radbaz, writing back in, I think it's the 15th century, maybe the 16th, says life belongs to God. It's not up to you to do that.
Oh,
Well, when you talk about death, it's really, when you talk about death, no, it's life and body are the same thing. Even in a case of wounding, the Talmudic phrase is, what's the difference between killing someone fully and killing someone partially? That's the idea. Others have added elements to this argument. Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz, source number 9. He was the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom before Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. People forget there was such a thing as a chief rabbi before Rabbi Sacks. He made such a big imprint. But Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz was remarkable, and really it's worth taking a moment to explain. He was, I think, more than anybody else, the one to pioneer a special field of Jewish medical ethics. Classically, Jewish medical ethics were part of the general body of Jewish law. And you wrote about Jewish law, and that included medical issues and what do you do in medical cases. But he was the one who started writing articles and books about medical ethics as its own field, and that encouraged others to do so as well. Very, very large impact on the field. So here you have a statement of his in source number 9. He says, "The value of human life is infinite, and therefore cannot be divided. Each portion of it is infinite. It then emerges that 70 years of life have the exact same value as 30 years, or 1 year, or 1 hour, or 1 second. This demanding definition of the sanctity of human life is founded not only on strict mathematics or logic, it is founded equally upon ethical considerations. If human life were to be diminished in value because its end was near, human life would lose entirely its absolute value and receive relative value. Relative to life expectancy, health, benefit to society." So he makes two separate points here. Right? Point number one is, if life is of infinite value, then all life, even very, very brief life, is of infinite value. And then his second point is, if you're going to say, well, this life isn't that important, or this life isn't that worthwhile, then why can you only point the finger at that particular case? Others could decide that it's true for this or for that. The Asperger's case, the case of the minor, whatever the case may be. And so that's another argument. A third argument that's made to justify the stance that a person is not able to take their own life is faith, which I understand is a very difficult argument to make for people. But take a look at source number 10. This is from the story of King Chizkiyahu. King Chizkiyahu, we are told in Tanakh, was dying. And the prophet Yeshaya, the prophet Isaiah, says to him, you better take care of your affairs because it's over for you. And as the Talmud expands on the conversation between Yeshaya, Isaiah, and King Chizkiyahu, the discussion becomes a philosophical debate. He says to him, what have I done wrong? And why is it that God is going to take me? So Isaiah replied, it's because you have not been involved in procreation. You didn't try to have children. Chizkiyah explained, I saw in a divinely inspired vision that I would have bad children. He says, I knew that they weren't going to turn out well. Isaiah replied, what business do you have in the secrets of the Merciful One? You should do as you're instructed, and God will do whatever pleases God. And as the story plays out, he marries Isaiah's daughter, thinking that you have a righteous king, and you have the leading prophet of the time, and between the two of them, hopefully things will work out. And their son is Menashe, who's an idolatrous king, who burns Torahs and does terrible things for 22 years. Then he does tshuva, then he repents, but it's too late. The damage is done. So the vision, whatever vision this was accurate. But the key here is playing God. That's the point. You have a certain role, you have certain duties to perform, and it's not for you to second-guess God. And that argument is made to justify the statement that one is not allowed to wound oneself. This is not a new problem, right? The problem of assisted death and the problem of people suffering and needing some kind of release from their suffering, it didn't spring up in the last 30 or 40 years. This is an old issue. What's made it more of an issue today are two things. Number one, the growth of a rights-based culture, right, in which we don't emphasize duties as much as we emphasize rights. And number two, the medical technology that we have, which will enable us to extend life a lot longer when somebody is suffering. Somebody who, go back 50, 100, 200 years, and certainly more than that, somebody would have passed away simply because we didn't have a respirator, right? Or fill in the blank with whatever other device you want. We didn't have the surgeries. We didn't have the equipment that we could use to see what's going on inside their bodies. We had no idea what was going on, let alone how to treat it. So they would have passed away. Today, we have the ability to take care of problems which extend people's life, but potentially also extend suffering. But I say this because I want to show you a comment that was made in 19th century Germany. One of the biblical texts regarding murder, right after the flood. God says, I am going to demand the life of somebody who has been murdered. I'm going to demand the punishment of the murderer. In the Hebrew it says, Miyad ha'adam, miyad ish achiv. Which I translated here in the English, from the hand of Adam, from the hand of man, and from the hand of ish, his brother. Meaning, from the hand of the murderer. But the text is unusually wordy. From the hand of man, from the hand of the man, his brother, I will demand payment for his life, effectively. Not payment, financial payment, but I will demand his life. So Rabbi Jacob Tzvi Mecklenburg wrote the following. The Torah doubled the term Adam and Ish. It said man twice. And also joined the word brother to it. Apparently there are two forms of murder. Harming the victim by avenging oneself upon him, taking his property and the like, right? Where you want to enrich yourself or avenge some injury or some embarrassment or whatever it is, and therefore you harm somebody. That's number one. Or benefiting the victim when he is immersed in great pain and he would choose death over life. In other words, what he's saying is, because it's not as clear when you read it this way. I'll explain. What he's saying is there are two forms of murder. There is miyad ha'adam, one person kills another, and then there's miyad ish achiv, when a person kills somebody as a brother. What I'm doing is merciful. What I'm doing is meant to help. This person is suffering. And he says what the biblical text is saying is that in both cases it's still considered murder. I bring it here not because it adds something to the legal discussion, we've already seen this point of view. But in 19th century Germany, somebody is reading the Torah, looking at it through that lens, and saying, what do you do? In fact, we're going to see it go back to Talmudic times shortly. So if I were to stop here, I would say, so one may not kill, even if it's for a positive intention. However, there are two bases in Jewish tradition, including legal tradition, for modifying those clear-cut rules to be a little more permissive. And this goes back to the question I asked in the beginning, which is, can taking a life be considered a medical act? Number one, there is the idea that causing somebody physical harm in a manner of healing, with the goal of restoring health, can be considered medical treatment. We saw this in the cosmetic surgery discussion. If you remember Rabbi Feinstein's statement that we read at the end of the session, I did not bring it again on the sheet here, but he said it's not called wounding someone if you're doing it to improve their situation, not to overpower them and not to take something away or harm them. But I'll make it even stronger with this passage from the Talmud in source number 12. And this is what I meant when I said that the issue goes back a long time in our history. This issue of assisted death. This is the story of somebody who was identified in the Talmud as Rebbe. Rebbe's full name, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda the prince. He was the political leader of the Jews of his day, which is end of the 2nd century, beginning of the 3rd century. He was also the leader of Jewish scholarship of his day. He is the canonizer of the Mishnah, the first core text of Jewish law to be put into writing. He is the one who is responsible for that. He is the be-all and end-all of his day. When you go to Israel, go to Tzipori, they've done a lot in the archaeological digs to find what he had. That was where he lived in his day. So his death was devastating beyond devastating for the Jews of his time. He was the one who liaisoned with the Romans and dealt with all issues with the Roman Empire. He was the one you turned to with all legal questions. He was the biggest. So he's at this stage, he is dying. He had some kind of a bowel disease. There actually are papers that have been written trying to figure out from the scant Talmudic evidence what it was that was wrong. But his maid, as he is suffering, and as the students are in the yeshiva praying for his life, his maid ascends to the roof, and she says the following: "The heavens request Rebbe, and the earthly realm requests Rebbe. May it be God's will that the earthly realm should overpower the heavens." Yeah, restore him to us. Let him live. When she saw how often Rebbe had to go to the washroom, removing his tefillin, phylacteries, and then putting them back on, and how he was in great pain, she said, "May it be God's will that the heavens should overpower the earthly realm." She prays for him to die. The sages were not silent in their prayers for God's mercy. So she took a pitcher of water and threw it from the roof. Right? Smashes on the ground. The noise distracts everybody. The praying people paused, and Rebbe passed away. Now, there's so much to talk about in terms of this story. The idea that the prayer was what was keeping him alive, the idea that them pausing in the prayer is what takes his life, but she is praised in the literature on this story as having been right. And that's the point that I'm trying to make here. The idea that this is not raising your hand to somebody. She doesn't kill him. She doesn't administer some kind of a potion that's going to kill him. But you can recognize in this story that death can be considered beneficial. That's the point that I'm bringing here. There's a lot of discussion about this. Is one allowed? Is it okay to pray for somebody to pass away? There's a lot of literature on this. There are some who say yes. There are some who say yes, but not if you're the caretaker, because that gives you a conflict of interest. There are some who say absolutely not. You should just say, God, do whatever is best for the person, and then let God work out whatever that is. There are different perspectives, but again, what it shows us is the idea of death as advantageous. That's number one. That's one mitigating point. The second mitigating point is that suicide may not be prohibited in all cases, even though we always talk about it as though it is. May not be. And I base this on examples in Tanakh and Talmud. Take a look, please, at source number 13. The end of the first book of Shmuel Aleph. Saul is at war against the Philistines. He is the king. The war turned heavily against Saul. The archers found him, meaning the enemy archers. And he suffered greatly from the archers. And Saul said to his armor bearer, "Unsheath your sword and stab me with it, lest these uncircumcised ones come, stab me and mock me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was very afraid, right? He's going to be the one to kill the king. And Saul took the sword and fell on it. Right? That's the origin, falling on one sword. That's the story that it comes from. And the Talmud, in discussing it, does not criticize Saul. Just the opposite. It says he deserved full honors, he deserved eulogy, and so on. All the things that you've heard that are done or that are not done when somebody takes their own life do not apply to his case. Second story. Going to Roman times. The Romans are trying to get these Jews to stop rebelling against them. They issue a decree. They issue numerous decrees. They prohibit the teaching of Torah, they prohibit the ordaining of teachers, and so forth. With penalties of murder for those involved, penalties of murder for others as well, in the event that someone breaks the rules. Well, Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion is one of the 10 martyrs. If you remember the poem about the 10 martyrs that's recited on Tisha B'Av, the other poem about them that's recited on Yom Kippur, so he is one of those who is murdered by the Romans because he teaches Torah. And he's challenged by one of his colleagues, "Why are you teaching Torah in public? You know they're going to catch you and kill you." And he says, "All right, so then I'll die from this. Better that way." And so sure enough, they catch him. And look at number 14. "They brought him and wrapped him in a Torah scroll and bound him with vines and kindled them. They brought wool sponges and soaked them in water and placed them on his heart so that his life would not depart quickly." They want to torture him. "His students said to him, 'Open your mouth and let the fire enter.' that he should allow himself to die by smoke inhalation. He said to them, better that the one who gave it take it back, and not that I harm myself. He is not willing to do anything to harm himself. The executioner said to him, the Roman fellow, my master, if I were to increase the flame and remove the wool sponges from your heart, would you bring me to the next world? And he replied, yes. The executioner demands that he swear, and he swore that this would be so. So that he encourages the executioner to act, to hasten his death. He's not willing to do it himself, but he's willing to have the executioner do it. Now, there are differences between these cases and other cases, right? For starters, the fact that they're clearly, in both cases, going to die immediately, right? There are also mitigating factors in each case. In the case of Saul, he's concerned also that they're going to use him to demoralize the nation. He talks about them stabbing him and mocking him. Perhaps he's also concerned, as some commentators note, that there might be some kind of mission to try to rescue him, and that people are going to get killed trying to save him from the Philistines. In the case of Hanina ben Tradion, it's more about removal of an impediment to dying, as opposed to actively doing something, although they do mention here raising the flame as well. As a matter of practice, I have yet to see a Jewish authority who is willing to say on the basis of this that suicide in the case of pain would be advised. That's not something you'll ever see. What you will see is source number 15. Rabbeinu Asher, one of the most important pieces of Jewish legal tradition, his son wrote the Tur. First of all, Rabbeinu Asher himself was a leading authority in Germany in the 13th century. And then due to persecution, he fled from there to Spain. And the reason why that matters so much is that he bridges the world of Ashkenaz and Sfard. He comes from the Ashkenazi world and he brings all of that with him. He's already a leading figure there to Spain. And he becomes a leading figure there as well. So what he says matters to both communities. His son, Rabbi Yaakov Baal HaTurim, is the author of the Tur, which is one of the major codes of law in Jewish tradition and is what leads to the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, which is written shortly thereafter. So what he says carries a lot of weight. And he writes, suicide was permitted, he's talking about for King Saul, as seen in the Midrash, quote, but only, God says in this, it's quoting a biblical verse, but only your blood for your lives I will seek. From your lives I will seek your blood. This is a prohibition against taking one's own life. Ve'ach edimchem l'nafshotechem edrosh, miyad kol chaya edrishenu. I'm going to demand your blood for your lives. So I might say that this is true even for somebody who is being pursued, meaning you're not allowed to take your life, even if you're being attacked by somebody else, as Saul was. I might think it would be prohibited. But he says, look at the first word of the biblical sentence, ach, or as I translated it here, but. That's an excluding word. It says, not so fast. This rule isn't going to apply to all cases. It doesn't apply to a case like Saul. Therefore, he was not within the category of willful suicide, and on that basis, we have a tradition going back many centuries that if somebody takes their own life, Rahman al-Itzlan, we don't deprive them of honors. It's very rare. I know people have heard of somebody who takes their own life not being buried in a Jewish cemetery and so forth. It is extremely rare that that is implemented. I think I've mentioned it in this room at some point in the past. I have memory of mentioning it. When I was a rabbi in Pennsylvania, I once had a funeral out of town in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I went there, and it was either the rabbi or the cantor, I forget, showed me a particular grave. And he said, that person used to be buried outside the cemetery. Because they had taken their own life. They were buried outside the cemetery. But what happens, unfortunately, with cemeteries? They need more room. They grow. And so that person ended up being inside the cemetery as the cemetery expanded. It's extremely rare for that to be carried out, because the general assumption is that they must have been dealing with something so terrible that we don't consider them to have made a sound decision. What he is saying here is that aside from that consideration, that what they made was not a sound decision, they were pressed into it by whatever they were suffering from, he's making a statement that in Saul's case, he deserves full honors because this is not called willful suicide when it's done to avoid the things he was trying to avoid. So what that means is, again, we have precedent for saying that that harming somebody, performing an act of physical harm, may actually be considered medically beneficial and a healing act. And number two, that suicide may not have this ironclad prohibition in all cases. And maybe those lead to a mitigation of the statement that you're not entitled to take your own life. And instead, we should say, there's an imperative to relieve pain and suffering. However, there are also concerns on the other side. There are policy issues on the other side. For example, creating an approved type of suicide increases pressure on others to take that option. Take a look, please, at source number 16. This is an abstract from a study of other studies. The article, Suicide and the Media. This article reviews 42 studies concerning the relationship between nonfiction media reporting and portrayal of suicide and actual suicidal behavior and ideation. Studies of nonfiction, newspaper, television, and book accounts of reported suicide were examined. Results show an association between nonfictional media portrayal of suicide and actual suicide. The more the media talks about suicide taking place, the more likely that people will perform it. The association satisfied sufficiently the criteria of consistency, strength, temporality, specificity, and coherence for it to be deemed causal. There really is cause and effect. That's what they are finding. I'm not saying this study is the end of all studies on this. This is an issue that has been studied many times. You can see this is a meta study. They're studying 42 other studies on the topic. My point is that that's a policy consideration here, which is, in the event that you're going to allow it, in cases which are extreme, you should know it will be applied in cases that are not extreme, because pressure will be applied for people to take that route. There's another policy concern. In the event that you license this as the way to deal with people who are in great pain, you reduce the imperative for society to find other ways to deal with people who are in pain. If you think of a city that says, we're going to solve the homeless crisis. What are we going to do to solve the homeless crisis? So some cities will say, well, that's really easy. We'll criminalize it. Right? We'll criminalize it for someone to sleep out on the street. Then that way, we'll force them all to either go to shelters or go somewhere else, or they'll stay in jail. Or another place says, I know how we'll solve the problem. We're going to build another shelter. That sounds very nice, but you know that that's only a stopgap solution. It's not as though now you've taken care of all of your problems because you added a few dozen or even 100 more beds. You haven't solved the problem. What you've done is you put a Band-Aid on it, a better or worse Band-Aid, and kicked the problem down the road a little bit. The same thing is true here. This is a solution in the sense that it says, okay, we have people in pain. We don't know what to do for them. Here's an option. They can take their life. But it doesn't actually work on the medical investments that are needed and the financial investments that are needed to take care of people who are in pain, because you say, well, we've solved the problem now. There is no homeless crisis anymore because we dealt with it. And so from a policy perspective, there are concerns. So, what do we do with all of this? Right? Now that we've got, 12 minutes left, and by the way, I am going to stick around at the end for more discussion, and because I know monologuing on this is hard. People have things that they want to say. But what do you do here? So, the conclusion of Jewish law, based on every writer I have seen on this topic, is that at the end of the day, you can't call ending a life a medical act. And that's what I meant when I said in the beginning that the conclusion of Jewish law is relatively straightforward. I have yet to see an authority in Jewish law who will rule that all of the mitigating factors I presented are sufficient to override the prohibition against murder. However, there are two points that have to be made. Number one, there is an absolute requirement to pursue all means of palliation. all means of relieving people's pain. So take a look at source number 7. Rabbi J. David Bleich, normally a very sober writer, talks about the issue of treatment of the terminally ill in this 1996 article. And he says, every prudent effort should be made to alleviate the patient's suffering. This includes aggressive treatment of pain, even to a degree which at present is not common in current medical practice. Physicians are reluctant to use morphine in high dosages because of the danger of depression of the cerebral center responsible for respiration. That's what we talked about before. The effect of morphine administered in high doses is that the patient cannot control the muscles necessary for breathing. There is, however, no halachic objection to providing such medication in order to control pain in the case of terminal patients, even though palliation of pain may ultimately entail maintaining such a patient on a respirator. Similarly, there is no halachic objection to the use of heroin in the control of pain in terminal patients. The danger of addiction under such circumstances is, of course, hardly a significant consideration. At present, the use of heroin is illegal, even for medical purposes. Judaism affirms that everything in creation is designed for a purpose. Alleviation of otherwise intractable pain is a known beneficial use of heroin. Marijuana is effective in alleviating nausea. That is a side effect of some forms of chemotherapy. There is every reason to believe that these drugs were given to man for the specific purpose of controlling pain and discomfort. Jewish teaching would enthusiastically endorse legislation legalizing the use, with adequate accompanying safeguards, of those substances in treatment of terminal patients. He believes that we have to do more in controlling the pain of the patient, and he's willing to consider what others are not necessarily willing to consider. There's a practice that they call snowing the patient. You've heard this term? Snowing the patient? So this refers to high levels of sedation, which may even reach the point of continuous sedation. This can't be done, I'm told, very long term. But Rabbi Mordechai Halperin in Israel was asked this question: is that appropriate? Take a look at number 18. The questioner asks, I wish to receive counsel and guidance regarding my 91-year-old mother who has fractures all along her spine due to osteoporosis. Recently she fell and was bounced around, and since then she has experienced great pains. The advice of the doctors is to sedate her to prevent pain. According to the doctors, she will not return to walking or to moving her lower body. She can move her arms only lightly. However, she is still lucid. The question, may one go along with the doctor's advice and introduce her into sedation to prevent pain? I understand that this sedation will become a permanent state for the rest of her life. And the response is, the discussion is of a lucid woman, therefore this depends exclusively upon her desire. One should ask her directly. But if that's what she wants, then that's what you do. I was asked this question by a doctor who's in palliative care. They wanted to know, you mean they're not going to be able to do mitzvot? They're not going to be able to, fill in the blank for whatever mitzvah you want to ask about? And the answer, I think, is as written here. If this is what they want in order to remove their pain, it can indeed be justified. Including the case where, go back to the double effect discussion, it may shorten their lifespan. And that's based on source number 19, where Moses ben Nachman Ramban is the basis for what we already said earlier, when he said, if it's not guaranteed that this will kill the patient, then you're allowed to use it, and you do the best you can. You make your best judgment, understanding that it might accidentally lead to the death of the patient. However, there's one more point, and this is highly controversial and exactly the sort of topic you never discuss with 6.5 minutes left. But this is what we got. The truth is, yes, we could have done a 4-part miniseries on this topic. But the last point, as controversial that it is, requires presentation. And that is, in addition to saying that we have to find all means of palliation, bless you, there are ample grounds for saying that you don't have to continue medical treatment to prolong life. And this is something that involves a lot of debate. And I want to quickly show you 4 different views along the spectrum within Orthodoxy. Understanding that, you should speak to a competent rabbinic authority for all practical questions. I'm going from one extreme to the other. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who we mentioned earlier, as well as Rabbi J. David Bleich, who I quoted earlier, are of the belief that life has to be preserved, and you have to keep on going and do everything in order to keep the patient alive. Take a look at number 20. Even though we see he is in great pain in his death throes, we still may not act to hasten his death. That's for sure. The world and all of its contents are of God, such is his will. But he continues to say, that's actually not his own. He's quoting somebody else. I didn't bring the full quote, which I should have. But he is of the belief that all life must be preserved. You may not fail to do that which is necessary to extend life. And that's one view. Second view says short-term life need not be extended. Even though we said before that short-term life is also important and that it's viewed the same as long-term life, in truth we know it's not true. For example, classic Jewish texts deal with the horrific case in which there's a fire and there are multiple people who are trapped in the fire. And somebody goes in and says, well, I have two people in front of me and I have one person who, even if I get them out, they're only going to live a couple hours. And somebody else who, if I get them out, they can live much longer based on their assessment and as they're standing there at that moment. And the answer is clear. You take the person who could live much longer. So that tells you there is a distinction between long-term and short-term, even though Rabbi Jacobowitz insisted that all life is of infinite value. On that basis, take a look at source number 21. Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, also known as the Stipler, a leading authority in Jewish law in the 20th century, says, regarding the basic principle that one must do everything possible to extend the life of a patient, even though it is only temporary life, in truth, I also heard statements like this in my youth. But I don't know whether it comes from someone reliable. In my eyes, this requires great examination. He quotes you a passage in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law, where it is clear that one may remove an obstacle to the death of a patient when that would also prevent great suffering. One only may not act upon his body. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, deals with the question of somebody who is dying, but there's someone hammering outside the window. And the belief was that that's somehow catching the person's attention and keeping them in this world, even as they're suffering. So you tell the guy, stop hammering, in order to allow the patient to die. Leave aside the question of whether that has an effect or doesn't have an effect. That's not germane. What is relevant is that the statement is, you're allowed to remove something which is keeping this patient from dying. One only may not act upon his body. You can't do anything to take his life by acting on the person. If so, then I see no reason to prohibit sitting without acting, where acting would increase suffering. Just the opposite. One should learn from here to refrain from acting. And so he ruled, and Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, leading authority in Israel today, ruled that short-term life, where a person is suffering and we can't do anything about the suffering, need not be extended. Third view, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who we've quoted quite a bit elsewhere, says, and it's in sources 22 and 23, he says, you don't cause people suffering, whether short-term or long-term, if you can't cure. It's not about whether the person can only live a short time. Even if you have the capacity to extend a person's life for a long time, you could extend their life for years. If you don't have the ability to cure their illness, and you don't have the ability to cure their pain, then he says, don't extend. With a caveat, though. He insists on providing food and oxygen. Food and oxygen, he believes, have to be provided, which, of course, leads to all sorts of questions. Well, what about a ventilator? What about a feeding tube? Right? What about a trach? All the different questions that then come up, is that included in food and oxygen? But Rabbi Feinstein says in 22, and then he goes back and revisits it in 23 because he was challenged on it. He takes an even more liberal view, so to speak, than Rabbi Zilberstein. Again, Rabbi Waldenberg said, save everybody, extend everybody. Rabbi Zilberstein said, if it's only short-term life and you can't mitigate the suffering, then don't extend. Rabbi Feinstein says, even if it's long-term life that you could provide, but you can't mitigate the suffering, don't extend other than to provide food and oxygen. And then the last view. And the last view is of Herschel Schachter, who was a Rebbe of mine. And he takes the position that the people have a degree of autonomy to refrain from all treatment. He says, in a nutshell, it's based on a passage which we've actually discussed. Remember the discussion we had about the person who endangers his life in order to make a living? Right? The pauper who climbs the tree and all that. And we said that you're allowed to do that. You're allowed to say, for me to survive, I need to have an income, and this is the way I'm going to make my living, even though that incorporates an element of risk. So he argued that this presents a person with a degree of ownership over their life. And therefore, he argued, as I laid it out in number 24, that there are three different types of cases. In a case in which everybody would say, you pull 100 people on the street, and all of them would say, I want this treatment. Given the circumstances, given the case as described, given the pain, the suffering, the life, the death, the treatment, all of it as a package, if the person would say, if your average person on the street would say, I want this treatment, then the patient's not allowed to decline. That's all, I say the average person, what I mean is that every average person would say it. Opposite extreme. You pull 100 people on the street and none of them would want it, then the patient's not allowed to have it. Because what you're doing is torturing the person. You're harming the person more by extending their life. And effectively allowing him to die is a medical act. You're actually helping the person. You're not allowed to extend it. And what about all those cases in the middle where some people would say do it and some people would say don't do it? It's the choice of the patient. And I've had this, meaning I have the joy of not being a shul rabbi anymore. I miss it terribly, except on this issue. I'm very happy not to have to deal with these cases, but sometimes cases come to me anyway. And I've come back to Rav Schechter with this question about particular cases where the person had a set of circumstances in which some people would say yes, some people would say no, and they say, I don't want. And they don't want anything. They don't want food. They don't want oxygen, whatever it is. And I went back and I asked him the question, and his answer was, then don't provide it. So what we've said, and I recognize we're now 1 hour and 1 minute, what we've said here is this. We start out with the point that there is an imperative to relieve pain and suffering. That is part of our obligation. There is also a clear-cut prohibition against murder, including where it is a mercy killing, including where it is euthanasia. And pitting one against the other is going to lead me to say, no, you're not allowed to end somebody's life. We noted mitigating factors. The fact that you are allowed to perform medical acts which harm people physically where you are considered to benefit them. And number two, the fact that suicide is understood, if not condoned, in certain cases, like the case of King Saul, like the case of Rechanina ben Trajel. On the other hand, we have policy concerns. If you're really going to go in this direction, you create problems within society, pressure on people to take this option when they don't want to, and so forth. The bottom line out of all of it is that, again, I have not seen any authority in Jewish law who will rule that the mitigating factors here are sufficient to override the prohibition against murder. You can't act to take somebody's life. You are obligated to pursue all means of palliation, even where that potentially risks the life of the patient. And depending on the view, and there's a range of views, there may be grounds to not continue the treatment that is keeping the person alive. So that's my presentation on it. I will now stay as long as necessary for questions and discussion and so forth. Thank you very much. Please, if anyone has to go, and I certainly understand, if you go quietly, so that's a bad phrase for this class. I didn't mean that. If you could please, for those who have to leave, if you could just leave in a way that doesn't disrupt, that would be good, so we can continue the conversation. Okay, I see a bunch of hands. Andy.